Welcome to the final event for our National Lawyers Convention. We're very pleased to host the Honorable Robert H. Bork Memorial Lecture. Judge Bork was not only a friend of the Federalist Society, he was there at the founding of the organization. Not only was he there at the founding of the organization, he was a powerful presence and intellectual leader for his entire life. His memory, his very DNA, lives long within this organization and will endure, and I'm so pleased we are able to take some meaningful time to recognize his contributions to us and to the country with this important lecture. We have some special guests with us today, the family of Judge Bork, including his son Bob, his daughter-in-law Diana Bork, and granddaughter Claire Bork. Unfortunately, his wife, Mary Ellen, is not feeling well today and couldn't join us, but I welcome the Bork family. I also want to take a moment to recognize a special guest, a colleague of Judge Bork. He couldn't be in the room with us today, yet he is with us today watching on live stream. You know him or you know of him. He's a judge on the D.C. Circuit of Court of Appeals from 1985 forward, took senior status in 1996. He's a senator from New York, ran as a member of the Conservative Party of New York, whatever that is. Him and some other guy, I assume, maybe named William. He served in too many high-level government positions to list without postponing the start of this Bork lecture. He is the truly rare specimen, an intellectual giant who has served with distinction at the highest levels in all three branches of government. I speak, of course, of Senior Judge James Jim Buckley, a tremendously accomplished young man. We can't see you, Judge Buckley, but we welcome you here today to the proceedings. Now, presenting our lecture today is Judge A. Raymond Randolph, a colleague of Judge Buckley and also a colleague of Judge Bork. Judge Randolph was appointed to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in 1990, chosen by President George H.W. Bush. He served his country for decades. He has been an assistant to the Solicitor General, Deputy Solicitor General. He's served in private practice. He's been special counsel to the Committee on Standards of Official Conduct of the United States House of Representatives, also known as the Ethics Committee. Do they still have that? He served as Special Assistant Attorney General to the state of New Mexico, to the state of Utah, to the state of Montana. And he's been an adjunct professor at Georgetown and the George Mason Scalia School of Law. He served on too many boards and commissions to name, but my favorite highlight from this unending list of accomplishments is the fact that he, in 2005, delivered the 5th annual Barbara K. Olson Memorial Lecture. I urge you to go home tonight and watch that stirring lecture. It's available on the YouTube channel, the Barbara K. Olson Memorial Lecture from 2005, Judge Randolph. But for now, please welcome Judge Randolph.
His gifts were so great and so many that we would have envied him if we had not loved him. For years, we knew that this was a man of extraordinary talent, but the warm haze of friendship, obscured at first, became gradually clear that he can be called without hesitation or embarrassment a great man. With those words, Robert Bork began his memorial tribute to Alexander Bickel, the preeminent constitutional scholar of his day and Bob's dear departed friend at the Yale Law School. Bob also had great gifts, and between us there was a warm haze of friendship for nearly 40 years. And without hesitation, Robert Bork should be called a great man. When Bob's son, Robert, who's here tonight, learned that I would be giving this talk, he reminded me that I would be speaking at the end of this conference, and he recommended that I should keep it light. Good advice, and I'm going to follow it. So in this tribute, my aim is to provide a glimpse of Robert Bork's brilliance, his courage, his honesty, and his impact on the law, and his wit, especially his wit. And to those qualities, I have to add one more. Robert Bork was a true patriot, a word we hear too little of these days. Samuel Johnson told Boswell that eminent men are least eminent at home, that bright characters lose much of their splendor at a nearer view. Not so with Robert Bork. The more you were with him, the more you came to know him, the brighter he became. Last Tuesday's federal elections triggered a memory for me. It was of the presidential election in 1992. I stayed up late that election night watching the returns until it became certain that Bill Clinton of Arkansas, a student at Yale, by the way, of Bob's, along with Hillary, had won the presidency. So early next morning, the phone rang, and it was Bob. And in his rich baritone, he said, "There's a time to fight, and there's a time to leave the country." So those looking for clues about the man I'm going to talk about tonight might take these tidbits from his youth. As a senior in high school, Robert Bork was a boxing champion. In his junior year, he was class president. And during high school, his pets were snakes. And one more thing. In 1944, in the midst of World War II, and at the age of 17, Robert Bork enlisted in the Marine Corps. Years ago, at a gala dinner, I think it was the American Enterprise Institute, my wife and I, Lee, were seated at a table with Supreme Court Justice Byron White and his wife. And Justice White asked me, and I just can't recall why he was asking me, but he said, "Ray, what do you think the most important piece of legislation Congress had thus far enacted in the 20th century?" And he answered the question himself. It was, he said, the GI Bill, because it enabled millions of returning World War II veterans to attend college. Robert Bork was one of those millions. And after a two-year tour of duty in China, he returned and enrolled in the undergraduate program at the University of Chicago. He made up for lost ground rather rapidly. He gained advanced placement in one course after another and graduated from undergraduate school in just 2 years, Phi Beta Kappa. Bob then enrolled in the University of Chicago Law School. And after his first year, while he was in the Marine Corps Reserve, the Korean War started, and he was called up again. And after serving another 2 years as a lieutenant this time, he returned to Chicago to finish law school. He took a course in antitrust law, a course he described as the beginning of the law and economics movement. It was also the beginning of his lifelong fascination with antitrust law. As Bob told it, his antitrust professor was Edward Levy, a young man then. Professor Levy believed in the Supreme Court's antitrust decisions, but Levy invited a professor from the economics department, Aaron Director, to co-teach the course. And this had unforeseen consequences. Director proved that the Supreme Court's antitrust decisions made no sense, that the court's economic reasoning was something the justices were just making up for the case before them. Bob said that in this course, he learned his first lesson about oral arguments. When Aaron Director was closing in on Ed Levy logically, and Ed couldn't see an escape, he would begin to make fun of Director's mustache, which Bob said is the way to argue a case when you're stuck. So I wondered about this strategy in 2001 when Bob presented an oral argument in our court in the Microsoft antitrust case. And Judge Ginsburg is with us, and you remember that case, Doug, I think, yeah. And Bob was then in private practice, and he was representing a company called Netscape. I don't know whether, is Netscape still in existence? I don't know. I was on the court's 7-judge in-bank panel, and Bob was claiming that some decree or another issued in the case was unclear. So our colleague, David Sentell, interrupted him, and he said, "Mr. Bork, how could you possibly think this decree is ambiguous? You might as well say that a no smoking sign is ambiguous." And Bob, a heavy smoker, replied, "Yes, and I've taken advantage of that many times." Bob graduated from law school in 1954, but stayed another year as an assistant to Professor Director. And during that year, he published his first law review article. It was entitled "Vertical Integration and the Sherman Act, The Legal History of an Economic Misconception." After his year with Aaron Director, Bob joined the Chicago law firm of Kirkland & Ellis as an associate. His colleague and friend, Dallin Oates, another Chicago graduate, also started at Kirkland, but left after 3 years to begin a career teaching at the University of Chicago Law School. By the way, Dallin later became president of Brigham Young University, a justice on the Utah Supreme Court, and then a member of the Council of the 12 Apostles of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But when they were together at Kirkland in the late 1950s, Dallin let Bob know that a top graduate of the University of Chicago Law School had been turned down. And he was turned down because he was Jewish. And at the time, the pattern in Chicago and New York was for Jewish firms to hire Jewish graduates and for non-Jewish firms to hire non-Jewish graduates. Anyway, Bob was outraged. And although he was a mere associate, he protested and caused quite a stir among the other associates. So the hiring partners relented, and Howard Crane became Kirkland's first Jewish hire. Years later, Howard Crane became the managing director of Kirkland & Ellis. So Bob stayed at Kirkland for 8 years, practicing antitrust law. He made partner, but he was not very happy in the practice. This is how Bob recalled the experience. "I'd be taking depositions or defending depositions, and when you take a deposition, you have to be alert and try to get the guy boxed in. But when you're defending, all you have to do is sit there and make sure they don't smuggle in something to the record that was going to prejudice you. Well, that's not too exciting, and it would go on for days, and there could be 20 depositions in a case. So I found myself listening to the depositions and working the New York Times crossword puzzle. And at that point, I knew I was not cut out for private practice." John McGee, another associate at Kirkland in the antitrust portion of the firm, and later a professor, I think, at the University of Washington, remembers Bob saying, and I quote, "I don't want to spend my life practicing law and cash in at the end, leaving nothing but a trail of depositions, briefs, and money." So on his 80th birthday, I asked Bob about this. He said, "I was 2/3 correct." In 1962, Bob gave up his partnership at Kirkland, packed up his Chevrolet convertible, and with his wife Claire and their 3 children, headed east to the Yale Law School. As an untenured assistant professor of antitrust law, earning a yearly salary of less than 1/3 of what he had been paid at the law firm. Bob also told McGee that he wanted to leave something enduring. To say that he achieved his objective would be an understatement. He became a great teacher, a wise judge, a penetrating and influential writer, a formidable Supreme Court advocate, and a captivating speaker. Only a few years after Bob arrived at Yale, the presidential election of 1964 pitted then President Lyndon Johnson against the conservative Senator Barry Goldwater from Arizona. The press dubbed Goldwater an extremist. So the senator issued a famous rejoinder. It said, "Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Moderation in pursuit of justice is no virtue." By then, Bob had become known as the Yale Law School's token conservative, a label I think he relished. As the 1964 November election approached, Bob described what he called the real atmosphere of at Yale at the time. And this is how he put it. "The election between Goldwater and Johnson was upon us, and I was sitting in my office when two young men appeared from the Yale Daily News and said they were looking for two professors in the entire university to write a column for Lyndon Johnson and two professors to write a column in support of Barry Goldwater. They said they had hundreds of volunteers for Johnson, but so far had found only one Yale law professor, or Yale professor, for Goldwater. And they had a suspicion I might be the second. I did the principled thing. I told them, go away, I haven't got tenure." So 3 days later, they came back. They said, "We can't find another professor in the entire university." And so I relented and wrote a column supporting Goldwater. The next day, all hell broke loose. People were coming into my office to argue with me. I tried to explain, but very often, at the end of the confrontations, they would say as they were leaving, "You must be crazy." Well, the elections came and went, and the two young men appeared at my office again. And of course, Bob said, I was delighted to see them. They said, "We want to take you to lunch to meet the other Goldwater supporter." And I went, and I met him, and he was crazy. In addition to teaching antitrust, Bob devised a new course, and he called it constitutional theory. He thought that antitrust, in its use, I'm quoting him, in the use of highly general provisions, resembled much of the Constitution. But as with the antitrust, the constitutional law had grown up based on an inadequate understanding of the limits of the judge's role. So one day while he was teaching, Professor Alexander Bickel dropped in on Bob's course. And the two of them held an impromptu debate in front of a vastly amused class. That led to perhaps the most popular offering at Yale Law School in the 1960s. A constitutional theory course the two men jointly taught in good-natured fashion. Bob and I co-taught a constitutional law course in the early 90s at George Mason, but it could not even approach the Bork-Bickel course, not because of Bork, but because of me. But to give you an idea of what went on in their class at Yale, here is Bob's account of one of the exchanges. He said, "At the time, I was enthralled with John Stuart Mill in his book on liberty and the famous harm principle. So I said in class one day that as to the interactions of individuals, unless there was physical touching, the state was not entitled to stop somebody from anything." And Bickel said, "Oh yeah? Suppose I engage in indecent exposure." And Bob said, "Well, don't worry about that. The law already has a doctrine to take care of it." And Bickel said, "Oh yeah, what doctrine?" And Bob said, "De minimis non curat lex." Uh, Richard Nixon was reelected in 1972, and early the next year, he nominated Bob to be Solicitor General, and Bob was easily confirmed. At the time, I was an assistant to the Solicitor General, who was then former Dean of the Harvard Law School, Irwin Griswold. I'd started in the SG's office in 1970 directly from my clerkship with Henry Friendly, but by 1973 in the spring, I decided to try private practice. I did have a chance to meet Bob. He came down from Yale Law School at one time just to meet with the staff and have lunch. And although he had been confirmed, he would not be taking office until the Supreme Court issued its final opinions for the term at the end of June. As the date approached, Bob and his family took a brief vacation at a friend's house at Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. And Bob's experience there became a metaphor for what he was about to encounter when he took office in the SGs. So here's Bob's description of what happened. He said, "I went swimming while the rest of the family stayed on the beach. Unfamiliar with ocean swimming, I was caught on an outgoing current and began to be pulled out to sea. I waved my arms frantically to get help from the family. They mistook the gesture and waved back." The Solicitor General conducts the government's, as most of you know, conducts the government's litigation in the Supreme Court. And with the summer approaching and the court and the justices headed for the hills after they've issued their last opinions, it's usually the quietest time in the SG's office. But it would not be that for the newly arrived Solicitor General. After just 2 weeks, President Nixon summoned Bob to the Oval Office and asked him to resign. Why? Nixon wanted Bob to be his chief defense counsel in the expanding Watergate investigation. And it was expanding because it had just been discovered there was a fellow named Alex Butterfield, I think his name was, who testified before a Senate committee and revealed that conversations in the Oval Office had been recorded. Special prosecutor, former law professor at Harvard, Archibald Cox, wanted the tapes. He claimed they might shed light on President Nixon's suspected involvement in the Watergate break-in or the cover-up, and the White House was resisting the demands. So Bob was stunned at the president's request, as you can possibly imagine. He said he needed 24 hours to think it over. And his pal, Alex Bickel, happened to be in Washington at the time. So he came to Bob's home, and they stayed up all night drinking and devising a strategy. Not exactly a good combination, but. So the next day, Bob went to the White House, and he announced that he could not decide whether to accept the president's offer unless he first listened to the tapes himself. And he would later describe this encounter as the best oral argument he ever made. The White House chief of staff told Bob that his demand was impossible. And so Bob respectfully declined the president's offer. And I should say that in his writings and speeches, Bob never denigrated Richard Nixon. In fact, he praised him. He said that he was impressed by Nixon's knowledge of legal philosophy, and he was always rational, incisive, courteous, relaxed, present. And Bob and I talked about this several times, and I had the same experience when I was in private practice because I was representing Richard Nixon at the time. That was not the beginning or the end of the crises that Bob had began facing in the SG's office. It was the middle of the Vietnam War, and the strategy of the Defense Department was to, there was a safe haven for the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese, and it was in Cambodia, and President Nixon authorized the bombing of Cambodia. And Justice Douglas, who was then summering at his home in, I think it was Goose Prairie, Washington, issued what amounted to an injunction against the bombing as circuit justice. Now, let me tell you a few words about Justice Douglas to put this in perspective. Richard Posner, Judge Posner, former Judge Posner, called him uncollegial, irresponsible, not to mention rude, ice-cold, hot-tempered, ungrateful, foul-mouthed, and self-absorbed. Well, my first encounter with Mr. Justice Douglas occurred at a reception in the Supreme Court conference room, a sort of celebration of the opening of the 1970 Supreme Court term. Back then, there were regular social interactions between the members of the SG's office. I think there were only about 10 of us at that time, and the Supreme Court. So not all of the justices were there at the reception, but my colleagues, SG colleagues, formed the usual pods around the few justices that were there, except Justice Douglas. And he was standing off to the side, alone, smoking a cigarette. So as an uninitiated 26-year-old, I went up to him and introduced myself as the newest member of our office. He asked me where I went to law school, and I told him. And then he asked where I grew up. And as I was midway through an answer, he turned around and walked away. So another encounter will give you an idea. When I was arguing a case back then, and I argued pro hoc vici, which is Latin for this time only. And I was too young to be a member of the Supreme Court bar, so each time I argued, the SG had to make a motion for my temporary admission. So my colleagues in the office by that time had warned me that Douglas never paid any attention at oral arguments. They said, don't let it bother you. But this time seemed to be different, or so I thought. So while I was arguing, Douglas kept looking up at me, smiling, by the way, and then he would look down and write, and I assumed he was taking notes of my fantastic presentation, of course. And so I had one of these out-of-body experiences. I'm sure many of you have had it. You know, I was simultaneously arguing a case in the Supreme Court and answering the questions of the other justices while thinking to myself, my God, I've got Douglas's attention. Then, as I was wrapping up, Douglas looked up at me again, and staring directly at me, he picked up an envelope and licked it. He had been doing his correspondence. So as to Douglas's order, Bob quickly wrote and filed a motion. The other justices, they didn't have Zoom back then, but they had telephones, and the other eight justices had a telephone conference and overruled them. And Douglas dissented. I think it's a printed dissent if you want to see it. Then, that was not the end. As the summer wore on, another crisis loomed. The United States attorney in Maryland had uncovered evidence showing that Spiro Agnew, Nixon's vice president, had been taking bribes while he was governor of Maryland. This raised a unique constitutional question. Could the vice president of the United States be indicted and tried while he was in office? Agnew's attorneys, claiming vice presidential immunity, filed a motion to prevent the grand jury from proceeding. Bob, on behalf of the United States, wrote a brief in opposition within 5 days with Keith Jones in the SG's office. And it had a meeting with President Nixon, and Nixon agreed with the position that for the United States, that yes, the vice president could be indicted and could be tried while he was still in office. That led to Agnew's resignation from the vice presidency. He pled guilty, by the way, to tax evasion and served no prison time. And that fall, Bob carried out the President Nixon's order to fire Special Watergate prosecutor Archibald Cox. Cox was threatening to hold the President of the United States in contempt for refusing to abide by a subpoena Cox had issued for the tapes. And Bob did the firing because the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General refused to do it and resigned, and then asked Bob to do it and asked him not to resign. He was the third in line in the Department of Justice. The press dubbed this, you've probably heard it, the Saturday Night Massacre. But Bob would always say he preferred to call it, quote, the events of October 20th, 1973. So 2 years later, Bob offered me the position of Deputy Solicitor General, and I accepted, of course. And by that time, Edward Levy, Bob's former professor at Chicago, had become Attorney General. And down the hall was the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Office of Legal Counsel, Antonin Scalia. And the Office of Legal Counsel, or Legislative Affairs, Assistant Attorney General was Michael Uelman, and Rex Lee was Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Division. All in all, I think it's safe to say that this Department of Justice was probably one of the most intellectually powerful departments of justice in our nation's history. And I must add, it was an ethical Department of Justice and an ethical FBI at the time. So in the SG's office, the great constitutional issues of the day filled our discussions as hundreds of cases poured in on their way to the Supreme Court for briefing and argument. And Bob took the most important and the most difficult, the death penalty cases. Buckley versus Valeo, that was Jim Buckley, by the way, when he was senator from New York, complaining about the Election Reform Act. National League of Cities and so on. His audience of nine considered him the greatest Supreme Court advocate of his time. And although the workload in the office was heavy, Bob always started each day with the New York Times crossword puzzle, which he rapidly solved. But he never tried to hide his morning ritual. The door to his office was always open, and he was there, sitting on the couch, pencil in hand, in full view of anybody and everybody who wandered by. And you might wonder why I mentioned something that appears so trivial. Let me tell you, closely examine that scene, and it will reveal something quite remarkable. You will see a confident man at peace with himself, a man with no urge to impress others, and Robert Bork was the rarest of the rare. He was a prominent and important figure with absolutely no pretense. While he was Solicitor General, Bob frequently gave luncheon addresses to various groups around town, and as you may imagine, he was very much in demand. I recall very little of his lunch talks, but one of his favorite lines has stayed with me. He would tell his audiences, I'm quoting, "During the turbulent period of the late 1960s, when the radical students at Berkeley hit the Ho Chi Minh Trail to invade the colleges of the East, I thought the greatest hope for higher education in America was the San Andreas Fault." I try to talk him out of that because Berkeley's not on the San Andreas, it's on the Hastings Fault. And he had none of that. He said, "Yeah, you ruined my punchline if you do it." So during those years in the SG's office, our friendship ripened and became deeper and deeper still. And when President Ford lost the election to Jimmy Carter in 1976, Bob and I started planning to form our own law firm. And we coordinated, by the way, with Howard Crane at Kirkland. But we didn't get very far. Another opportunity, a different opportunity beckoned for Bob, and he had to accept it. Alexander Bickel, at the age of 49, had passed away from cancer, and Bob was asked to be the first Alexander M. Bickel Professor of Public Law at Yale. And so he left and went back to Yale. And while there, he published his first book, The Antitrust Paradox. He had basically finished that book before he even became Solicitor General. But in keeping with his character, he decided it would be improper to publish it while he was in office. In the preface to The Antitrust Paradox, which is still in print, by the way, he wrote, "Much of what's said here derives from the work of Aaron Director, who has long seemed to me, as to many others, the seminal thinker in antitrust economics and industrial organization. I had the good fortune to be a student in 1953 and 1954, the latter year a graduate research associate. Bob added, closely associated with director was Edward Levy, without question the most brilliant classroom teacher I have ever seen. Throughout his book, Bob dismantled one after another of the Supreme Court's antitrust decisions. And Bob was a master of the art of delivering devastating criticisms on paper or in person, and often with twists of irony and wit. And he would do so to the high and mighty, including the Supreme Court. As a matter of fact, anybody else he thought had it coming. Bob explained, the root trouble with modern antitrust, more damaging even than the confusion over the goals, is the unsophisticated, indeed primitive state of the law's economic doctrines. Antitrust policy, he added, cannot be made rational until we're able to give a firm answer to one question and one question only. What is the point of the law? What are its goals? As Professor George Priest, a friend of Bob from Yale, put it, Bob distilled the economic learning of the Chicago School into a single workable standard for antitrust analysis, the consumer welfare standard. So the antitrust paradox, as Judge Ginsburg knows better than anyone, revolutionized antitrust law. And from its publication in 1978 through the present, it's by far the most cited text in Supreme Court antitrust decisions. To quote George Priest again, it is not an exaggeration to describe Bork as providing the foundation for modern antitrust law. After his wife Claire passed away, Bob came back to DC after talking again with Howard Crane and to his old firm, Kirkland & Ellis. He felt there was nothing left for him at Yale. And within a short time, he was nominated to the DC Circuit and took the oath of office in February of 1982. We were at a cocktail party right around that time, Bob and I. And by this time, the antitrust paradox had already made an enormous impact. A book came out. It was entitled The Harvard Guide to Influential Books. 113 Harvard professors discussed the books that have shaped their thinking. Bob's antitrust paradox made the list. At the party, the cocktail party, a young fellow came up to us and referring to the Harvard Guide, which had gotten a lot of publicity, he asked Bob, quote, how does it feel to be included as one of history's greatest authors, along with Thucydides and Plato and Socrates? And I could almost hear Bob wince. His reply was classic Bork. He said, I'm not sure how it feels. Socrates never wrote anything. Bob was later joined on the DC circuit by his old friend from the Justice Department, Nino Scalia. I'm going to reveal a little known fact, and that is that Bob was largely responsible for Nino's getting on the DC circuit and then the Supreme Court of the United States. When Ronald Reagan took office in 1981, his choice for Attorney General was William French Smith. Nino, who was teaching at the time at Chicago, wanted the Solicitor General's post. Smith did not select him, and they had a rather heated exchange over the telephone. When an opening occurred on the DC circuit, Bob was instrumental in patching up the things between and the animosity between Nino and William French Smith. And Nino was nominated and confirmed. While they were together on the court, Bob and Nino rarely disagreed, as you can imagine. And they were very much enjoyed each other's company. One day, they were on a panel hearing oral arguments. An attorney from out of town kept saying, yes, Judge Scalia. No, Judge Scalia. Yes, but Judge Scalia. And finally, Judge Bork couldn't stand it. And he said, counsel, it's not Judge Scalia, it's Judge Scalia. And Nino said, thank you, Judge Burke. In 1982, Bob and Mary Ellen were married. Mary Ellen had attended one of Bob's speeches. It was my wife, Lee, that puts it, it was love at first listen. And Nino and I were ushers at the wedding, and Howard Crane was the best man. And the wedding reception, in fact, took place here at the Mayflower. And no doubt, because of Mary Ellen's influence, Bob eventually converted to Catholicism. He was 76 years old. It was a small group. We were at the Catholic Information Center, and Hadley Arcus was there, and my wife Lee, and several other people in the scattering of priests. Also, I don't know if you remember this, Hadley, Mel Gibson was there. You know, and I think it was because he was researching his movie, The Passion of Christ. But anyway, so after the ceremony, Kate O'Byrne, who was there and became Bob's godmother, along with John O'Sullivan, who was a writer for Maggie Thatcher, who became Judge Bob's godfather. So Kate O'Byrne hosted a gathering at her home. It was a small group, maybe a dozen of us, including several priests. And one of the priests asked Bob to say a few words. So this is what he said. I still remember it. He said, "There's an advantage in waiting until you're 76 to be baptized, because you're forgiven all your prior sins. Plus, at that age, you're not likely to commit any interesting new ones." So by 1987, Bob had enough of judging, on our court at least. It was, as he put it, the trivia, it's the Joseph Conrad novel. What is it? Heart of Darkness, right? That ends the horror. So, but he put it as referring to our court, the trivia. And he admitted that, you know, there were cases with considerable legal significance, but the bulk of the docket consisted of regulatory agency cases, which Judge Scalia then really enjoyed, but Bob Bork did not. And to hear him tell it, he said, you work on it, and maybe you think you finally get it right, but when you're all finished, what have you got? A completed crossword puzzle nobody will look at. But in June, Justice Lewis Powell resigned. And a few weeks later, in early July 1987, President Reagan nominated Bob for the Supreme Court, which had a rather different docket than the D.C. Circuit. As a matter of fact, during the hearings, Bob was asked about why he wanted to be on the Supreme Court, and he described their docket as an intellectual feast, which did not exactly come off very well with the press, and the anti-intellectual press. So the Senate Judiciary Committee delayed the confirmation hearings for two and a half months, actually, until the middle of September. And that turned out to be key, because as the summer wore on, the radical left, led by Ted Kennedy, mounted a multimedia campaign of lies and distortions. The supposed all-powerful center of government, the White House, did hardly anything in response. The so-called Iran-Contra affair was then consuming its attention. And I talked about this last night. I had dinner with Brendan Sullivan, who represented Oliver North in that. By late summer, to give you an idea how bad it got to the point where the White House telephone operators started referring calls about the nomination and Judge Bork to me. I was in private practice. Bob had been preparing for his hearings at his home on Palisades Lane, and Lloyd Cutler, Brad Reynolds, myself, others were helping him. Mr. Cutler, by the way, was Jimmy Carter's White House counsel and became later became Bill Clinton's White House counsel. But while we were spending hours reviewing and discussing legal theory and Bob's speeches, many speeches, articles, and opinions, the opposition was reaching a fever pitch. Our goal was to be meticulous about the truth. Their goal was the opposite. So the much anticipated televised hearings on Bob's nomination were to begin on September 15th, 1987, a Tuesday. That Monday, I called Bob to suggest that we go up to the Capitol Hill and scope out the Senate caucus room, the scene, ironically, of the Army-McCarthy hearings. We arrived to find the door to the room open The lights were dimmed low. TV cameras were aimed. The tables were set. At the far side of the room, there was a young senator arranging papers. And as we walked in, he saw us and was quite startled. And he said, Judge Bork, we'll be seeing you tomorrow. And Bob said, it's tomorrow? And the guy broke up. So Bob testified for the next 5 days, including an extraordinary Saturday session. The Democrats on the committee were a majority. By a margin of 8-6, one of the six Republicans was Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, once a Democrat, then a Republican, and then a Democrat again. The committee chairman was, anybody know?
Joe Biden,
right. Flanked on his left by Ted Kennedy. And both had stated their vehement opposition to Bob before the hearings began. Biden, by the way, also had announced his candidacy for the Democrat presidential nomination that summer. And he was hoping that the Bork hearings would boost his chances. But during the hearings, Biden's presidential aspirations came to an end, at least for that moment. In his campaign speeches, he was plagiarizing Neil Kinnock, a candidate for parliament from Wales, and he got caught. A rather evident lack of imagination, by the way, on Senator Biden's part. I mean, Neil Kinnock, you know, he. If you're going to plagiarize somebody, why not Cicero or Pericles or even Daniel Webster? But no. But one of the Democrats' main attacks was that Judge Bork was out of the legal mainstream. You know, I've heard this many times, and I've really never understand why that should be considered damning. I mean, the charge has no intellectual content. It tells us nothing about truth. Albert Einstein was out of the scientific mainstream, and thank God he was. But it did not matter to Joe Biden or to Ted Kennedy or the other six Democrat senators. It didn't matter that the Supreme Court had never reversed any of Bob's judicial opinions, or that his antitrust paradox had by that time defined the mainstream of antitrust law. These senators, joined by the faux Republican Arlen Specter, focused, or their staffs focused, instead on Bob's 1971 Indiana Law Journal article entitled Neutral Principles and Some First Amendment Problems. To quote Professor Steve Calabresi, one of the founders of this great organization and a former Bork clerk and then a Scalia clerk, Bob's 1971 Indiana Law Journal article laid the intellectual groundwork for originalism. His Neutral Principles article is now widely considered a classic in legal literature. In it, Bob offered a withering critique of judicial activism by the Supreme Court. He was particularly critical of Griswold versus Connecticut, the 1965 Supreme Court decision striking down a state statute, making it a crime even for married couples to use contraceptive devices. In his article, Bob wrote that judges must be neutral in the application of principles, and that was not a unique position of his. It was a point made by many academics, most famously, I think, by the Columbia professor Herbert Wexler. But that was not enough. An additional discipline was needed. And to put it the way Bob did, if judges are to avoid impressing their values, imposing their values upon the rest of us, they must be neutral as well in the definition and derivation of principles. And there is only one way that can be done in constitutional issues. As he put it, one must take from the document the rather specific values that the text or history show the framers intended. Griswold and the many other cases he discussed in his article failed that test. In a speech he gave in April 1987, also here at the Mayflower, by the way, several months before he was nominated for the Supreme Court, Bob made a prediction. When I first wrote on original intent in 1971, one of my colleagues at Yale told a young visiting professor, don't bother with it because the position was utterly passé. And indeed it was. But it was more than passé. It was, I think, the future. It may take 10 years. It may take 20 years for the wave to crest, a crest it will, and it will sweep the elegant, erudite, pretentious, and toxic debris of non-originalism out to sea. I can see him waving. Bob's prediction has, of course, come true. Originalism is now the mainstream. Was it Elena Kagan who said we're all originalists now? I think so. Back in September 1987, as the Senate hearings opened, things were very, very different than they are now. And the great Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming, a Republican member of the committee, remarked, here we go again, the 4-H club of hype, hurrah, hysteria, and hubris. As Bob tells it, the Democrats and one Republican specter professed horror at the thought that a judge must limit his rulings to the principles of the actual Constitution. Joe Biden, the chairman, would throw his arms up in the air and say, I have rights because I exist. It did no good to tell him that might be true, but a judge was not empowered to enforce rights not found in the law. Senator Biden, then still on the campaign trail, tried to demonstrate that he could hold his own against Judge Bork. A big mistake. Senator Simpson, I'll give you an example, was giving Bob a chance to give a full explanation of his view of Griswold and his privacy rationale when Chairman Biden interrupted. The actual testimony, which I'll read to you, went like this. Senator, Bob began, there's a lot of privacy in the Constitution. Griswold, in which we were talking about a Connecticut statute which was unenforced against any individual, Griswold involved a statute which banned the use of contraceptives. And Justice Douglas began the opinion with a rather eloquent statement of how awful it would be to have the police pounding in the marital bedroom into the and it would be awful. And it would be awful, but it would never happen because there's the Fourth Amendment. Nobody ever tried to enforce that statute, but the police simply could not get into the bedroom without a warrant. Now let me say this, Chairman Biden, would the senator yield at that point just for a clarification? Senator Simpson, yes, certainly, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Biden, if they had evidence that a crime was committed? Judge Bork, nobody ever tried to enforce the Connecticut statute, but the police simply could not get into the bedroom without a warrant. And what magistrate is going to give the police a warrant to go into this bedroom and search for signs of the use of a contraceptive? I mean, it's a wholly bizarre and imaginary case. Chairman Biden, if they had evidence that a crime was being committed. Judge Bork, how are they going to get evidence that a couple's using contraceptives? Chairman Biden, wiretap. And Judge Bork replied, wiretapping? Chairman Biden, wiretap. Judge Bork, you mean to say a magistrate's going to authorize a wiretap to find out if a couple is using contraceptives? I mean, how can that be? You know, hey, Bill, you know, guess what I'm doing with the wife? So, Chairman Biden, they could they not, under the law? And under his breath, and the microphone caught it, Judge, and it's in the transcript, Judge Bork is saying, unbelievable, unbelievable. As Bob put it afterwards, this question of privacy became a generalized thing. If you're against the right of privacy, what you mean is you want the government in the bedroom. And it was impossible to straighten that out, even with so powerful an intellect as Joe Biden. Bob testified for 4 more days, enduring one distortion of his record after another. The Democrats would read loaded questions prepared by their staff. And when Bob answered, rather than engage, they'd read the next loaded question. On the last day of Bob's testimony, Senator Simpson spent his questioning time quoting portions of Rudyard Kipling's poem, If. It was right on the mark. If you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them up with worn out tools. If you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it. And which is more, you'll be a man, my son. Robert Bork was a man's man, always a Marine, always courteous, courageous, loyal to his principles and to his friends. Bob resigned from the DC Circuit in February 1988. A few months later, he gave his first speech in the wake of the nomination battle. And it was to the Federalist Society Student Convention at the University of Virginia Law School. Bob, as Dean pointed out, had been very much involved in the formation of the Federalist Society, first as a faculty advisor in 1981 when he was at Yale, and then through the years as co-chairman of the Society's Board of Visitors. The hearing on his nomination galvanized the Society and it has grown exponentially ever since. Bob once said that the rise of the Federalist Society was one of the most important developments in American law in his lifetime. I will close on this note. Bob told his Federalist Society audience that day that, quote, keeping a constitutional republic requires ever-constant attention to its principles. It's important, therefore, to understand exactly what happened in my recent experience and what is the proper role of the courts in a democracy. The battle about that is not over, and I intend to be in it. And he was, until the very end. Albert Einstein was right when he said greatness in the world of ideas is basically a question of character. The main thing is never compromise. Robert Bork never did. In his many books, and in his articles, in his speeches, and in his interviews throughout his remaining years, he was steadfast in defending the constitutional ideals on which this nation was founded. Thank you.
Judge Randolph, if you could indulge us for just a moment, we're going to have a short presentation and then an announcement, but bear with us just, and let me call Bob Bork Jr. to the stage if I could.
Wanted to give you this.
Can you
should I come out there?
Yes, please.
Wanted to Wow. Give you this bust of my dad.
Thank you very much, Robert.
And now, another D.C. Circuit Court judge, we have an announcement from Judge Douglas Ginsburg.
Well, Ray, first, thank you for that wonderful hour. It was just terrific. It gives me a great personal pleasure to tell you that the Antonin Scalia Law School is establishing the Robert H. Bork Professorship of Law. Bob was my colleague and friend, not nearly as long, unfortunately, for me as yours, but I held him in great esteem. And we have aspire at the Scalia Law School to have the professorship inaugurated by 2025, That's attracted the interest of a number of generous donors and the support of the Bork family. And the law school itself has matching funds available to help support this this project. In 2019, the Dorothy and Allison Rouse Fund created gave a $550 million gift to the Scalia Law School because of the great admiration they had for Justice Scalia. And that bequest was placed in a permanent endowment for the purpose of funding more than a dozen new professorships. The chair, honoring Judge Bork, will allow the faculty recipient the financial flexibility to advance his or her instructional program and goals, develop new ideas, fund students' research work, and make innovative advances in their portfolio. Furthermore, following a generous gift from the Rouse family, the law school is in the position, as I mentioned, to match the endowment fund established by the family. I cannot gild the lily that we just experienced from Ray, and thank you so much, but I will take one moment to say I was reminded by your remarks, Ray, of Bob's decision to leave the court. I went to see him in that February of 88 in his chambers and tried to persuade him not to do that. It was far too late, I didn't realize. But I've never been a fan of the Chevron doctrine, and I can tell you how much less of a fan I became when Bob said, "I just can't go on deciding whether the secretary was reasonable." Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Ginsburg, for that great news. I want to take a moment to thank personally Judge Randolph for a remarkable address, a lecture. Thank you so much, Judge Randolph. I don't want to conclude without thanking the one group that I haven't thanked at all this entire 3-day period, and that's the staff of the Federalist Society.